Chapter 48. Moscow, Russian Federation. Dmitrovsky Administrative District. Friday, September 1, 6:38 p.m. The two-bedroom apartment was spacious and well-lit, with a southern exposure. It was new and empty of all furniture, which only heightened the sense of size. It was everything Boris had promised. "It will be like living in a gymnasium," Ivana said. The building manager, who was showing it to them, smiled agreeably. From his wheelchair, Vladimir said, "It will fill up fast. My stuff will take up an entire bedroom." "Everything is to European standards," the building manager said. "High-speed cable in every room. It's all very modern." He was a short, unshaven man, the kind of new Russian who'd secretly become rich in the last decade. Down a hallway, they heard laughter. "It seems a bit noisy," Ivana said. The man shrugged. "Not so much. We do have a few light-hearted types, but it is not an issue. They are reasonable. You will find this as quiet as any such building in Moscow." "When is it available?" Vladimir asked. If he wanted silence, they would have to move to a Dacha in the country. "Now, of course, today I will need your decision and the deposit if you decide to take it before you leave. I have others scheduled to see the apartment later." "Perhaps we could have a moment to talk in private?" Ivana said. "Of course, I'll return in 10 minutes. Ivana walked about the open space, stepping briefly into each room. "What do you think?" she asked her husband, who was sitting in the middle of the living room in his wheelchair. "It will do. It's expensive, though."
"You said you wanted more room. You said you have the money. I can keep looking, but this is the first suitable place I've found in 6 months.
Vladimir said nothing as he fumbled a cigarette out of a package and lit it. "I'd like to take it. I don't think I can stand our place any longer. I feel like I'm suffocating there." Ivana thought of the rent, more than she made in an entire month. She couldn't possibly make the payment on her own.
"Can we afford it, really?"
She still wasn't certain her husband was telling her the truth.
"Yes," Vladimir said irritably. "I wouldn't say take it otherwise. Why don't you listen to me?
And what if state security comes crashing in some night? What then?" Her grandfather had vanished in that very way. It had been the worst night of her life, one that came back to her again and again in her nightmares. She'd watched her grandmother wither away and die the following year. "That won't happen. I'm not working for the mafia. How many times must I tell you? I'm not breaking laws."
"You have. You used to brag to me about it."
"That was a long time ago. It was stupid of me to do that. And I don't think there were laws about it then anyway."
"But you were glad to do it. I remember how you told all your computer friends.
Then I learned hackers used what you learned and ruined computers or stole records. It was terrible. It's like you were a burglar or something. I want an honest life, lad. After all I've done, haven't I earned one?"
Vladimir lit a cigarette. "Yes, you have. Believe me, I've told you everything."
10 minutes later, he counted out 1,000 euros into the sweaty hands of the manager. Chapter 49. Manhattan, New York. Fisherman Platt and Cohen. Friday, September 1, 8:33 p.m. Jeff and Daryl said little on the shuttle back to New York City. Daryl had taken a window seat and stared morosely into the early evening sky. Jeff withdrew into his own thoughts, trying to make sense of the murders. Torture suggested someone wanted information. What could an IT manager know that would be of interest to anyone? Or the managing partner of a law firm? It made no sense, unless it was a psychopath. Difficult as it was to believe such people existed, he knew they did. He couldn't help but wonder if the murders were connected to Super Freak in some way. No one killed anyone over a virus, but this was no ordinary virus. The idea struck him as ridiculous, yet plausible at the same time, causing him to feel even more disoriented. As soon as the plane landed, Jeff called the IT center directly at Fisherman Platt and Cohen. He tried several times before boarding with no luck. This time Harold answered. He was clearly distraught and could scarcely speak, but managed to convey that he was still working his way through backups. "I'm going to the law firm," Jeff said to Daryl as they walked toward ground transportation. "Want to come?"
"If you think I can help."
"I do, and I'd like you to come." He could use the emotional support, he realized. Traffic as they entered the city was heavy as it made the transition into the weekend. The feel of Manhattan was different as night descended, it seemed to Jeff, or perhaps that was due to the murders. Suddenly his world seemed darker than it had been since 9/11. With a certainty that startled him, he grasped the connection. What had begun that terrible day in 2001 was continuing. Events that had cost him so much then were now poised to engulf his world again. He placed a hand on Daryl's shoulder, which seemed thinner and more vulnerable than ever. "We need to be careful," he warned her.
seated with him in the back of a cab. She turned to face him. There may very well be a connection between Super Freak and the murders.
Darrow looked at him as if he'd just slapped her.
The car bobbed as it hit a dip, then droned as it crossed a bridge with a metal surface. Jeff held her gaze.
I don't believe this is simply about hackers. It's clear to me it's something much bigger.
Her eyes grew round as she took in what he was saying. A few moments later, they arrived at the offices of Fisherman Platt and Cohen, taking the elevator to the IT center. Perhaps three associates were at their desks. Otherwise, the office was darkened and empty. Compared to when he'd first arrived, it seemed all but abandoned to Jeff. They knocked, then entered. Harold was there, his young face set with determination. He looked up from his computer screen with watery eyes.
Any luck? Jeff asked.
He'd expressed his condolences by telephone earlier when he'd asked Harold to stay over that day.
Yeah, I think I've located it.
Harold looked tired, but determined to do all he could to help. He'd had a crush on Sue. She'd been smart, knew computers, and treated him like an equal. Her death left him feeling empty.
Good, show me, then let us get to work.
When he introduced Darrow, Harold waved at her without interest.
How are you doing? Jeff asked as Harold typed,
even though he knew Sue's young assistant had been devastated by her murder.
I'm glad you gave me something to do. Sue always ran the show here and gave me instructions. I was lost.
He looked at Jeff.
I guess I should be looking for a job or something.
Probably. How's the firm taking the losses?
Pretty bad. Things weren't looking so great. Now this?
Some people...
Harold's voice trailed off, and he stopped typing.
Jeff placed a comforting hand on his shoulder.
Some people aren't so nice, you know?
Harold continued, his voice wavering.
They said, good, when we got word, as if Sue and Mr. Green had it coming from messing up. I just hate them.
Harold finished typing while choking back tears.
Go home, Harold, Jeff said, squeezing his shoulder. Get some rest.
Thank you for your help. I know how much Sue valued you and what you did. Try and remember the good, okay? It will help a little.
The young man nodded, looked at Darrow in farewell, then gathered his knapsack and left.
What are we doing? Darrow asked, as Jeff sat at the monitor.
I'm trying to find out what got Sue killed.
Harold had left the computer open in one of the chat rooms Sue had visited, but Jeff found that he couldn't really concentrate. Always in the past he'd been able to put from his mind any concerns he had. In fact, he'd buried himself in work after Cynthia's death primarily to block the pain. But he found he was still stunned at the murder of Sue Tabor and Joshua Green. He'd liked Sue. She'd been attractive, bright, and dedicated. He'd even come to like Green, though it was now more apparent why he'd dropped by the IT center so often. Still, he'd never pressed Jeff unreasonably for results as his clients often did. He'd seemed to understand the enormous job with which Jeff had been tasked. He was horrified at the thought of both of them tortured and murdered. Neither of them had deserved what was done to them. The extent of the evil he and Darrow were confronting threatened to overwhelm him. Memories both real and imagined of Cynthia and the awful death she'd suffered crowded his mind. But when he turned toward Darrow, the sight of her quietly working at Harold's computer, her attention totally focused on the screen in front of her, had an unexpected calming effect on him. She's right, Jeff thought, and she's exactly the person I want by my side.
Turning back to his own screen, he gave it his full attention. His time on Sue's computer was both tedious and unproductive. If Jeff had thought anything would jump out at him, he'd been mistaken. Shortly before midnight, Jeff and Darrow left the law offices. Darrow suggested they eat, but Jeff shook his head.
No, I'm not hungry. I'll join you if you want, though.
I'm not really hungry either, Darrow said.
Both of them were resisting, feeling defeated, in over their head.
Let's walk, Jeff said. Instead of taking a cab, the couple strolled to the Hotel Luxor, which Jeff had picked because it was only a few blocks from where he'd be working. The night was pleasantly cool after the closed space of the IT center. Servers had this habit of warming every space they occupied, and their constant electrical workings charged air in ways that were unnatural. It was good to be outside again, and Jeff wondered for a moment if he wasn't throwing his life away working in closed rooms. At the hotel, he held the door for Darrow, then collected his key from the night clerk who'd been reading the paper. The pair rode the elevator to his room. Across the street, Manfield spotted them at once. It had been a long 7 hours to wait. He hated stakeouts, but they were, he knew, essential to success.
The street had been quiet for more than an hour before he'd noticed this particular man. As Manfield watched the man enter the hotel, he was nearly certain he was the one. The man had done all right for himself, Manfield allowed, as he waited for them to take the elevator. The blonde with him was quite a dish. When the couple vanished through the closing doors, Manfield rushed across the street, ran toward the elevator, stopped, then muttered to himself. Spotting the night clerk, he behaved as if he'd just had an idea.
"Listen," he said as he approached the counter, "wasn't that Jeff Aiken I just saw? We were supposed to meet for drinks, but I was late. He'd mentioned he was staying here, so I tried to catch him."
The clerk was elderly, with a thick thatch of white hair and pale blue eyes. He'd been a doorman here before his legs gave out.
"I couldn't say, sir. Would you like me to check for you if Mr. Aiken is a guest?"
"Would you?" Manfield said with a warm smile. "That would be great."
The clerk checked the computer. "Yes, he's a guest."
"Wonderful. What room? I'll just pop up?"
"Oh, I can't give you the room number, sir."
"But I already told you," Manfield protested. "We're old friends, and I just missed him for drinks. He's expecting me."
"It had worked in the past, and there was no harm trying. I'll be glad to call him if you like. You can speak and make whatever arrangements you want."
Mansfield turned pensive. "Well, I'd hate to awaken him at this hour if I was wrong. He can be quite a bear.
Perhaps you'd like to leave a message then."
No, I'll just give him a ring first thing. Perhaps he'll have time for breakfast. You've been most helpful."
As Manfield left, the clerk stared after him, wondering what that had been all about. Certainly not what the man with the English accent claimed. He considered calling the guest and informing him, but the man was right about one thing. People hated being awakened at this hour. Instead, he turned back to his racing form.
Chapter 50 United Flight 914, Saturday, September 2, 12:47 a.m. George Carlton stretched out in his first-class seat and stared at the back of the seat in front of him. It had been a hectic day since his disturbing meeting with Jeff Aiken and Daryl Hogan. First, he'd attempted his emergency phone number to Fajr al-Dawar. The Saudi had insisted on his accepting it, and Carlton had repeatedly refused before relenting. He distrusted having the number at all, feared any direct connection, but had finally settled on memorizing it. Until now, he'd never used the number. That afternoon, he'd paid cash for a prepaid cell phone, then bought long-distance minutes. He'd called Fajr, and had, after several attempts, been forced to leave the cell phone's number and a message that the man call him at once. Then he'd stayed away from his office, pacing in a shopping mall parking lot, waiting on the return call. Their conversation had taken place that afternoon, and had done nothing to resolve Carlton's concerns, though candidly he had to admit his reluctance to speak frankly over an open line probably made that impossible. But there just had to be a plausible explanation other than the one he'd concluded. Finally, he'd insisted on a face-to-face meeting, telling the Saudi it was most urgent. Fajr had replied, "I'm only too glad to meet with you, but you must understand I am in Paris now on business. I cannot possibly get to the United States for another month at the earliest. I assure you there is no need for concern."
"Then I'll come to you," Carlton had answered. "I'll call this number when I touch down tomorrow. Be certain you answer it."
A hectic few hours followed as Carlton instructed his assistant to contact the travel office and arrange his priority departure. The young man had been surprised at the request, since from what he could see his boss never did anything on impulse.
"What do I say is the reason?" he'd asked.
Carlton had given this only cursory thought. "I must meet with my European counterpart at once. Set up a meeting first thing Monday morning, but I'm leaving tonight. I don't want to meet suffering from jet lag." He then spent half an hour poring over reports, searching for some justification for this abrupt trip. He finally located one that might make the case. In any event, he didn't abuse travel privileges. His boss might not like it, but Carlton figured he could sell it if it came to that. On the airplane, sleep wouldn't come. He'd had two double scotches since takeoff, but they'd had no effect. Only now, as Carlton turned his head and stared into nothingness, did he realize he'd neglected to tell his wife he was leaving the country.
Chapter 51 Manhattan, New York, Hotel Luxor, East 30th Street, Saturday, September 2, 12:59 a.m. There had been a moment when Jeff and Daryl left the law firm as they'd walked those few blocks to the Hotel Luxor, when Daryl knew she should have taken a taxi to her own hotel. She'd waited for him to say something, to thank her for her help, to arrange to meet the next day.
but instead he'd walked to his hotel, talking the entire time about what he'd just learned. She'd meant to say goodnight, but for the first time since they'd met, she sensed on some emotional level he needed her to stay.
"Now we know Sue was Dragon Lady," Jeff said, as they stepped onto the street, relieved at last to have some concrete information. "I traced her back 2 weeks to her first posting with it. She'd put up more than a dozen since the first, listing an email address for Super Freak to contact her at."
"What came of it?" Daryl asked.
"Nothing, from what I can see. There were a lot of crackpot replies, but only a handful read as if the writer had dealings with this Super Freak guy."
"What did they say?" she asked, hoping this was good news.
"He's supposed to be some kind of hacker legend. A few years ago, he found two vulnerabilities in Windows Vista shortly after it was released. He posted the details before Microsoft learned of them, so it was months before they released the patches."
"That's not protocol. He was supposed to advise Microsoft."
Jeff snorted. "Sure. But by publishing earlier, he gained credibility with the cracker community as someone who doesn't go totally by the rules. Since then, though, he's become pretty reclusive." Despite herself, Daryl found herself intrigued by the hacker's obvious brilliance. "Why can't people like that use their brains for the common good?" she thought. "What did the hacker say about him?"
"He's Russian, so we had that right, and he's a genius in writing certain viruses."
Daryl grimaced. "That's no surprise. Lately, his specialty has been rootkits. Since Jeff had first confirmed Sue had made indirect contact with Super Freak, he'd had an idea and decided now was the time to approach Daryl with it. You know, it's occurred to me that if we could talk to him and convince him, by hook or by crook, to give us all the rootkits and variants he's written, we'd be weeks, even months ahead of this. The vendors could do a rush job on signatures and patches."
"Then I've got good news for you. We've got a name," Daryl was grinning.
"How?"
"My team has been hard at work tracing the usage of the word Super Freak. We didn't have much luck in an open search, but got lucky in the NSA's archives of closed hacker forums and chat rooms. We found a key post from several years ago, when a hacker was chatting with Super Freak and called him Vlad. Then we searched for a Vlad and came up with over a dozen, but only one of them with a post related to the same technical data discussed in Super Freak chats. His last name was in the email address in the forum posting, vkoskov@zhtskky.ru. There was only one hacker forum posting using this account, but our search found it, which is why they say that everything you ever did is somewhere on the net. After that, it was simple."
"I would think he'd have been more careful," Jeff said.
"This was several years ago. I don't think he was giving security much thought then. His name appears to be Vladimir Koskov, and I have an address for him in Moscow."
"You think it's valid?"
Jeff wanted to believe this was their first real break, but it seemed too easy, too simple.
"Probably," Daryl nodded, "or at least I think it's where he was living when he registered that first email account."
Jeff paused a moment. "Someone should pay him a visit."
"I've already made the request, but it will be weeks before I get a response through channels, and even then it might not be a positive one. They have to go through the embassy in Moscow, and I'll be told they have better things to do."
"We don't have weeks," Jeff exclaimed. "Hasn't anyone figured that out yet?"
"Sure, you and me. That's about it. And the people we work with."
At that moment, they reached the Hotel Luxor. They entered the lobby where Jeff retrieved his key, and she went with him upstairs, all without either of them acknowledging what they were doing.
"Drink?" he said when they entered the room.
"Yes, bourbon if you've got it." Jeff opened the minibar, dug around, then produced a bottle of Jim Beam.
"I can get ice if you'd like."
"No need. And I'll drink it from the bottle, so forget about a glass."
He laughed, handed her the small bottle, then dug out a beer.
He popped the top, held it out for a toast. "To getting this asshole."
She smiled wanly and they drank. The beer tasted good going down, and for a second he considered drowning himself in an ocean of Pilsner. But he knew that was no answer, having drunk his fair share in the months after Cynthia's death. And for the first time since this whole ordeal began, he had some good news to hang on to, maybe even to act on. Suddenly, he was also aware that a beautiful woman, one to whom he was very drawn, was sitting there with them in his hotel room, and he was happy about it. He sat in a chair beside the small breakfast table and looked directly into her serene face.
"I haven't missed the fact that you're here in my hotel room," he said, finally understanding that though Cynthia was still with him, she was now only a memory, albeit a lovely one, no one could ever take from him. She'd been perhaps the most practical person he'd ever known, and he knew that she'd approve of where he found himself now.
Daryl sat in a nearby armchair, sipped her drink, and said,
I thought maybe you figured there was a cord connecting me to you or something.
It's the or something. He drank again, his mind back on their immediate problem.
I was thinking about what you said before, about backtracking to find out the identity of Super Freak. I bet that's how they found Sue DeBoer. I traced the email address she used, and it was registered in her name with a law firm address. There's so much on the internet now if you know where and how to look.
Of course. With that, they could have found a photo, even located some bio information on her.
Jeff nodded.
The internet, friend or foe, he intoned. Sounds like a bad evening news segment.
Daryl gave a small smile.
So you really think that whoever is in back of this avalanche of viruses killed her? There are dozens of people working on this.
Sure, but her they knew. And all they need to do is just slow things down. There isn't a lot of time left, remember? They wouldn't know how important she was to our effort. But if they're of that mindset, where's the harm in killing her? What do they have to lose? And she was the one asking about Super Freak. No one else was.
Daryl shivered. It gives me the willies if you're right. This means they have assassins available to kill people.
If I'm right, it looks like they do. But we can't know that for sure.
Daryl took another pull on the bottle.
Okay, killing her might make some sense, but why kill her boss? He was just a lawyer, for God's sake. You start down that path, where does it end?
Jeff shrugged. Because they were together.
You mean he got caught at the wrong place at the wrong time?
Probably.
Jeff thought back to his meetings with Joshua Green. The man didn't deserve his fate.
Consider what we've discovered up to now. We've dozens of variants, most encrypted and buried within operating systems protected by rootkits. So far, nearly all of them are triggered by the date September 11. And look at all the targets, including the ones we know and the possible ones. We're talking Wall Street, banks, the Fed, Social Security, to name a few. How about the power grid? You know how sensitive it is to tweaking, and it can be down for weeks, months even. You mentioned a nuclear power plant crashing, and there has to be a whole lot more I haven't even thought of. Not to mention that response systems require using the internet, and systems that route the internet might be killed off.
Despite himself, Jeff found his anger rising.
For me, the deciding point was when you said that the variants were targeting IP addresses for the United States and Europe. Given that, plus the number of people who must be involved, this attack is every bit as real as flying planes into buildings. The potential loss of life and economic meltdown is tremendous. It's what they were after a 9/11. They didn't pick the World Trade Center by accident. They knew how much disruption it would cause. It's as if they're after what makes Western civilization what it is.
Daryl nodded.
We've become so dependent on computers the Western economy would grind to a standstill if what we think is true. When computers only replaced what we did by hand, it wasn't so bad. You can always go back to doing it manually. Those hospitals I saw were forced to return to old procedures. They don't have enough staff to handle all the paperwork, and no one working there now remembers how it was done. They had to reinvent the system and made a lot of mistakes in the process.
But in too many cases, computers are doing things we can't do by hand, Jeff pointed out.
You've got computers instructing other computers. We can't replace that with a human being, and once we rebuild, we'll still be stuck with an internet system and a host of computers we can't trust.
Jeff finished his beer and opened another. But with a shake of her head, Daryl refused another bourbon.
If you transfer what's happened to Fisherman, Platt & Co. into any number of similarly sized businesses, Jeff said, not just us, but the world will go into a depression unlike any we've ever previously experienced. I can't imagine the level of unemployment and the resulting social implications.
It could be the zero day to end all zero days, Daryl agreed. This time we don't really know how extensive this will be until zero day.
And it's been going on for months at least.
Have you ever heard about an operation of this scope before?
She shook her head again.
Let's face it, we aren't even in the position of the little Dutch boy putting his finger in the dike. We can do all we can for the next 10 days, and a cyber apocalypse will happen regardless. There are so many variants, with such a high level of sophistication. We'll never solve this, not in time.
Jeff's face hardened as he made his decision.
We've got to get to the source so we can start on the countermeasures.
Koskov, Daryl said, her eyes opening in disbelief.
But we aren't secret agents. I wouldn't know how to go about it. I've sent my request, that's all I can do.
The two stared at each other while a feeling of sadness bordering on despair slowly crept over each of them.
Wordlessly, Daryl reached out to Jeff. He took her in his arms and held her tightly.
This had been a long time in coming.
He kissed her lightly on the forehead for the first time. His lips moved down her cheek. Then their lips met. He felt her stir, and they kissed more deeply. It was as if a wall between them had suddenly vanished, as if they were one. She gripped him fiercely, and the tenderness turned to passion. He ran his hands along her body, and then she murmured, "Get the light, Jeff. I'm really very shy."
Chapter 52. Paris, France. Cinquième arrondissement. Graphisme Corajou. Saturday, September 2nd, 8:44 a.m. 207 hours to go, Fajir El-Dawar thought. After so long, so many frustrations, and so many disappointments, not much time was left until all the work would be realized. Allahu Akbar, he muttered. In these long months, since he and Labib had launched their cyber jihad, Fajir had found himself increasingly torn asunder. The part of him that he thought of as Arab relished his role as warrior for Allah. The destruction of the West was the holy goal of all Arabs, he believed. The Prophet had decreed that Islam would, by force of arms, be the one true religion of the world. America and the West were the only significant obstacles to accomplishing that, and they were weak. Like an infant dependent on its mother's breast, the West now fed on computers and the Internet. Take them away and they'd be helpless. Fajr would show them that Arabs were strong, that there was no God but Allah. For all his personal wealth and power, he was secretly certain that Westerners despised him. The women he bought pretended enthusiasm, but he knew they looked at him with contempt because he was an Arab and a Muslim, just as did the men with whom he did business. Without his money, the West would condemn him to the most menial of places. Soon, very soon, he would set all that right. George Carleton stepped off the plane at Charles de Gaulle Airport and punched in Fajr's number. "Answer, you bastard, answer." "We?" "I've arrived. Where do we meet?" "How was your trip, George?" "Fine, just fine," Carleton grunted. "Where do we meet?" "You know the Notre Dame Cathedral?" "Of course." "Take a taxi to the left bank of the river, immediately opposite the cathedral. You will see a small park just east of the famous Chat Noir Cabaret. I will be seated there, awaiting you." "Say in 1 hour? And do not be so agitated. There is no reason. You have wasted a trip to a most beautiful city. Perhaps after you have had some rest I can show you the sights." Carleton clicked off the phone. It seemed to Fajr that fall would come early to Paris this year. He sat on a bench at the small park and smoked a Habana cigar as he waited for the American. The triangular park touched the street beside the Seine. On the other two sides, the expanse of grass and trees touched three-story apartment buildings, with two narrow alleys running away at an angle. Notre Dame looked just across the river. Fajr wondered idly how it would look remade as a mosque. Carleton had been useful over the years, but never so much as in these last few months. Until 2 weeks ago, Fajr and Labib had known with certainty that no one in the U.S. government who mattered had detected the jihad. The information had allowed Labib to launch ever more sophisticated malware into the electronic maze of the Internet. He'd been willing to risk creating a far larger pool of hackers than he'd originally contemplated. Today, 10 times as many viruses and variants were in the ether as they'd intended, all thanks to George Carleton. Fajr had not been surprised at the ease with which the American had been seduced and bought. His experience in business was that all Westerners were for sale. It was merely a question of finding the price or that lever unique to the individual. It wasn't all that difficult. With government officials, it was even easier. All in all, Fajr was pleased with Carleton, but this sudden meeting was troubling. 2 weeks before, the American had passed on information that told him U.S. CERT was targeting their viruses. Fajr had been agitated at the news, but Labib had assured him it made no difference at this point. Still, it was disturbing. Two French women walked by Fajr on their way to work, and he eyed them appreciatively. He had to admit, the women of Paris had a certain grace and fashion sense he'd never seen elsewhere. It was as if the women in London and New York aped their French sisters.
Fajer wondered for a moment what it would be like in Paris on September 12. Though the bulk of the attack was against the United States, many of the viruses also targeted European computers, and of course, the entire structure of the Internet would be under attack. Would he notice anything from this same bench? Would there be chaos in the streets? Or would the damage be confined to office buildings and financial institutions? He'd planned to be home in Riyadh for the event, but now reconsidered. Why deny himself the pleasure of witnessing disaster firsthand? A taxi pulled to a stop 50 feet away, and he saw Carlton climb out. Paying the driver, Carlton looked about, squinting in the morning sun, spotted Fajer, then walked toward him. The man was still wearing the suit he'd flown in and had not shaved. He looked angry. Fajer stood as Carlton approached. "Good morning," he said, extending his hand. Carlton ignored it and dropped to the bench. Fajer joined him. "Did you have a good flight?"
"No," Carlton almost shouted.
"Tell me what's going on, Fajer. What have you gotten me into?"
"Americans," Fajer thought with disgust. "Always in a rush."
"I've already told you. You supply information from time to time and are well paid for it. What about this super freak you're connected with? What's that?"
Fajer examined his cigar for a moment.
"It is part of the financial operation I told you about last summer."
"How?"
Carlton glared at the Arab. "Are you telling me the name is now of interest to your government?"
"I'm telling you nothing. I'm demanding answers."
"I already told you. It's distasteful, but I'm compelled to fulfill a family..."
"Cut the bullshit. This is an operation, isn't it?"
"Operation? I don't know how you are using the word."
"As in a mission," Carlton said, nearly as if talking to a child. "You're involved with people planting viruses on the Internet. Viruses meant to cause harm, not collect financial information. It's some kind of attack, isn't it?"
"Tell me what you know." Fajer had not expected this, not now. Not when he and his brother were so close. He could not imagine what had roused this man's suspicion.
"No, Fajer, you're going to tell me," Carlton demanded.
"I told you once, but I don't think you were listening. I may be a little bent, but I'm no traitor. I'm getting reports about the planting of a massive number of viruses in computers all over America. They've all got the name Super Freak in them, and that's the same name you're suddenly interested in. I insist you tell me what's really going on."
Fajer drew a discreet, calming breath.
"It's as I told you. The man who created these things apparently uses that name. I have only just learned about it, and thought it a more effective means for you to detect this financial business I told you about."
Carlton looked about them out of habit.
"I'm no fool, Fajer. You're destroying me."
Carlton realized he was sweating, and fought the urge to run his bare hand across his forehead. Clearly the American knew more than he was letting on. The Arab dropped his cigar to the ground and stepped on it with his shoe.
"Come with me. There are too many eyes for this to take place here."
He stood and began walking through the small park into one of the two narrow alleys. Carlton reluctantly followed, hesitating before entering the confined space.
"What else is it you know?" Fajer demanded.
Carlton glared at the man.
"These viruses. They've got the name Super Freak, all right. What you didn't tell me was they're triggered to go on September 11. Does the date sound familiar to you?"
"My God," Fajer said, feigning shock.
"The idiots. My friend, I know nothing about this. I think it's someone's idea of a bad joke.
The people doing this are Arabs. I've made no secret of that. One of the computer experts writing the code surely picked that date for its symbolic value. But these are not terrorists, I assure you. They are simply thieves. You can relax. Everything is fine."
For the first time since his meeting with Daryl and Jeff, Carlton felt doubt. Could Fajer be right? Was that all this was? Some Arab hacker filled with a bit of zealousness had picked 9/11 just to make a point?
"I told you," Fajer continued smoothly,
"that the code is being planted in thousands of computers and will be triggered to execute at the same time. As I understand it, a virus that is not functioning is harder to detect. so they want them all to launch on the same day. Some zealot picked that date for its irony. You know how young men can be. I'm sorry it has caused you this needless worry." Carlton struggled to remember what he'd been told and what he'd read. "These viruses, they destroy financial records. They don't steal them." Fajir pursed his lips. "They've sent out a great many. I suppose some might have interacted with certain computers in a destructive way, or more might have been destructive in application, but I assure you, that is not their purpose. They are not meant to destroy the computers." Now it came back to him. How could he have forgotten? He'd been a fool forever trusting this slick Arab son of a bitch. "What about airports?" Carlton demanded. "And dams? These super freak viruses are interfering with them. And that has nothing to do with finances. How do you talk your way out of that?" Fajir sighed. "I don't, my friend, I don't. You should have just taken the money." With that, he drew the shafra from the small of his back and plunged it deeply into Carlton's stomach as if punching him, then pulled it across his midsection with savage force. He watched the American drop to the ground with scarcely a sound, moving his mouth like a fish out of water. Carlton's eyes slowly rolled up as he struggled to breathe, lying in a growing pool of red. "You should have taken the money and kept your mouth shut. No one would have known, and there is nothing you could have done to stop this." Fajir wiped the knife on Carlton's clothes, then put it away. Fajir's cell phone rang. "Oui?" The Arab listened, then gave rapid instructions in English. By the time he'd finished, George Carlton was dead. Chapter 53. Manhattan, New York, Hotel Luxor, East 30th Street. Saturday, September 2nd, 9:05 a.m. The sun had already been up for some time when Jeff awoke. In the bathroom, he washed his face quietly. Returning to the bedroom, he sat at the desk chair, where he could see Daryl clearly. In this time of exhibitionist tattoos and body piercing, with the supposed equality of the sexes, it seemed to Jeff that many women were just mimicking drunken sailors on shore leave and their expressions of independence. One of the consequences, he believed, was that men of his generation, and those of the one coming up, seemed no longer to respect women or hold them in the esteem they once had. He'd always admired Daryl's fine mind and hard work as a professional. He'd been aware of the chemistry between them from the first moment they'd met, but since Cynthia's death, he'd been hollow, unable to react to any woman in an emotional way. Sure, he'd had relationships, but his heart wasn't in any of them. He thought that part of him had died with her. Now he realized that it had not. His attraction to Daryl had been so gradual, so natural. Awareness of it seemed to have snuck up on him like the first breath of spring after a particularly harsh winter. Daryl lay now with her head on a pillow, her face turned toward the morning light entering through the blinds. She looked as calm and innocent as a 5-year-old child taking a nap. Her elegant, lean body was stretched out, only partially covered by a white sheet. Her right breast rested against the bed. The other was half covered by the sheet in a provocative manner, as if a photographer had posed her. Under the cover was the rise of her hip, then the delicate line of her legs. It was a breathtaking sight. Daryl licked her lips. "You're staring at me," she said without opening her eyes. "Maybe." "No maybe about it. You're embarrassing me." Jeff crossed his fingers. "I'll stop." She rolled on her back, then kept turning until she stopped on her left side. Her back, Jeff decided, was as beautiful as the rest of her. "Promise me something," she said, her voice soft and low. "Anything." He uncrossed his fingers. Daryl jerked her head toward him and opened her eyes. "Careful what you say there, dude." "Anything." "It's pretty simple, actually. Don't worship me, okay?" Jeff laughed. "You mean like a goddess or something?" "More like an object of beauty or something, okay?" "I see," Jeff said, though he wasn't sure he did. "All right then, to me, you are a hag. We need to turn out the lights to do it, or put a paper sack over your head. Better?" She grinned. "Perfect. Don't look, I've got to use the bathroom." Jeff closed his eyes, then peeked the moment she stepped off the bed. Amazing. Once Manfield was satisfied Jeff Aiken and the blonde woman weren't coming back out any time soon, he'd gone to his hotel and slept 5 hours. He'd returned to his position at 6 that morning, where he waited patiently. It had been a risk, he knew, but he'd been too exhausted to maintain the watch any longer. He was reasonably certain his target had not left while he'd been gone. "Now what?" Darrell asked. She was scrubbed and dressed, though in yesterday's clothes and still felt grubby. "Go to the police?" Jeff had considered that at some length. "I can't think why. Would you believe our story of cyber terrorists attacking the United States, unleashing assassins to murder computer programmers and managing partners of law firms?" She couldn't help but laugh a little at the description. "When you put it like that, I guess not. So what do we do?"
"Eat. I've done enough thinking and an empty stomach. Maybe we'll come up with an action plan over an old-fashioned American breakfast."
"Meaning?"
"Coffee and bagels haven't been doing me much good lately. Time for some bacon and eggs. I know just the place."
Officer Jerry Kowalski moved to the corner of the intersection as far from the dirt and dust as he could manage. The overtime for covering street construction was welcome, but he hated the noise and grime. He was wearing old shoes and an unofficial pair of trousers close to the official blue of his standard uniform. Better they took the beating than the ones he wore on duty. He idly wondered if he could get away with wearing one of those surgical masks that people wore in Japan and Hong Kong. He decided he'd look stupid, and his uncle, the sergeant, would ream him out good, and the union would bump him to the bottom of the overtime list. As his uncle often said about the force, "Better not to stand out." The jackhammer started up again, and he slipped in his earplugs. Noise and dirt. What a mess. Then, across and down East 30th Street for the third time, he spotted the same guy hanging out in the alley. His partner had told him not to ignore his instincts. "If you're drawn to something, there's a reason. Don't talk yourself out of it," he'd say. Then tell Jerry to stop staring at the babes and for a change, try looking for illegal activity or scumbags up to no good. In Jerry's opinion, this guy really stuck out. For one, he was neatly dressed in a blue windbreaker, tan pants, and very white sneakers. Not the typical alley cretin living out of his shopping cart. For another, though he moved from time to time, he was pretty cool about it all, trying to be discreet without being obvious. The guy had to be up to something. The first time Jerry spotted him, all he'd seen was some subtle movement where it shouldn't be. It was as if he was waiting for someone. Yeah, Jerry thought, waiting in a skanky alley for his date. Something was going down for sure, though just what he couldn't decide. Across the street from the alley was the Hotel Luxor, and Jerry figured that someone in there had something to do with why the guy was waiting. With nothing better to do, he'd run down in his mind the possibilities. The guy could be a process server in a divorce action, or lawsuit. That struck him as pretty logical. The guy was dressed too neatly to be a panhandler, but upon reconsideration, he was also dressed too neatly to be a process server. Those guys were usually pretty ratty. He could be a jilted boyfriend. That was the one Jerry liked best. The guy was waiting for his girlfriend to get off work, so he could corner her and have a few words. Or, Jerry thought, maybe she was shacked up with some guy, and what the man in the alley had in mind was something other than a few words. Just then, the doorman opened the doors, and out of the hotel walked a stunning couple. The blonde was lovely, while the guy looked as if he could be a model or something. Both were trim, fit, looking the way everybody secretly wanted to look. Across the street, the guy in the alley stirred, and Jerry's eyes went straight to him. Alley guy started across the street. Not looking as if he were moving fast, yet covering the distance to the other side quickly, moving to intercept the couple. Jerry froze for a second, not certain what he should do. He spotted the guy slip his right hand into his jacket pocket. "Don't be a spectator," his partner was always telling him. "You want to watch crime? Watch Law and Order on TV. Jerry moved toward the couple, not even realizing that as he did so, he placed his hand on his gun. Alley guy was picking up his pace, and Jerry could see he was angling to reach the sidewalk just behind the couple, his hand coming out of the pocket now. Jerry felt the hair on the back of his neck stand up and his skin prickle. A man in an alley. A couple. People walking back and forth on the street. Nothing was odd about the movement itself. Jerry saw it 1,000 times a day on patrol. But this was different. He knew it. Jerry drew his weapon. Jerry himself was almost across the street, about 30 feet in front of and to the left of the laughing couple. Alley guy was maybe 20 feet away from them, still in the street, but almost to the cars parked along that side. His hand was in view now, and Jerry saw the pistol with the big nose on the barrel. A silencer, he knew, never having seen one in action before. But the entire gun looked just like one with a silencer they'd shown his class at the academy. "You!" Jerry shouted. "Drop that gun! Freeze!" On the sidewalk, Jeff heard the officer and turned toward him. The uniformed man was pointing his gun behind them, yelling at someone. Jeff looked and saw a man just reaching the parked cars, a gun in his hand. The man turned toward the cop, and Jeff heard 3 pops like subdued firecrackers, sensed rather than saw the officer struck with bullets. Then the officer's gun fired in a loud explosion, then fired again, and again, and again, as he tumbled onto the pavement, landing on his back. Jeff pushed Daryl forward without thinking. "Run! Run!" he said, as the pair broke into a sprint down the street, then around the first corner. Jerry felt the bullet striking him across the chest like heavy blows. Alley guy had been incredibly fast. Jerry cursed himself for missing him. The only bullet he'd fired that was even close was the first, but he knew it had gone high and wide. The others had gone into the cars or pavement as he lost his balance and fell. Shit. The cop had come out of nowhere. Manfield had seen him standing watch over the construction site and assumed he was some kind of traffic officer, which in England were always unarmed. Even if he was armed, Manfield had decided that with the noise and traffic, it was unlikely the cop would even see what he was up to. If he did, it would all be over before he could respond. Spotting the couple coming out of the hotel, Manfield had focused only on them. His instincts told him to kill both of them, but the man first, since he was the target. He moved across the street as quickly as he dared, drew his weapon, then heard the cop. He couldn't believe the man had actually been watching him. Spinning, he'd shot him 3 times in the heart, saw him topple over, then had taken off after the running couple, ignoring the gunshots in his direction as they weren't even close. At the corner, he turned and saw they were already well down the street. He looked back and saw the officer flop over on his back. He was talking into a communication device of some kind. At the construction site, the workers had stopped. It was silent. They were staring straight at Manfield and pointing. Pursuing the couple meant drawing the police to him, and a running gunfight in Midtown Manhattan made no sense. Manfield ran back up the street, then disappeared into the alley. Along the way, he wiped, then ditched first the pistol, then his windbreaker. Emerging on the other side, he flagged down a taxi. "Trump Tower," he said, then sat back in the seat and watched for trouble. 15 minutes later, he paid the driver, then entered the lobby of Trump Tower. There he drew out his cell phone and punched in the numbers. After several rings, a man answered. Manfield quietly explained what had just happened. He listened, then turned off the phone and put it away. He walked the 5 blocks to his hotel, ridding himself of the knife and the cell phone along the way. In his room, he showered, changed, then checked out. Outside, Manfield walked 3 blocks to a taxi stand. There he drew out his single die and rolled it into the palm of his other hand. 4. He went to the 4th taxi in line. "Driver, take me to Newark Airport."
"Certainly, sir," the dark-skinned man said as he got out to place Manfield's luggage into the trunk, ignoring the shouting of the other drivers.
As they sped off, Manfield sat back in his seat and replayed the events of that morning, wondering where he had gone wrong. It was the police officer, he decided. He'd made the assumption the man was incompetent. That had been his mistake. On East 30th Street, Officer Jerry Kowalski sat on the curb, still sucking in air when his uncle, the sergeant, arrived.
"What the fuck happened?" he demanded.
Jerry told him. Afterward, the sergeant said,
"Shit!
15 years I've been a cop and never fired my piece once. You're on a force what? 2 years and you're in a gunfight. And you didn't hit shit, you know that?
Yeah, I know. Jerry didn't need to be reminded. At least you did something smart.
What's that?
You wore your fucking bulletproof vest like I told you, that's what.
You struck 2 cars.
Before you leave today, I want a report. The owners are going to be screaming about this.
Chapter 54. Air France Flight 19. Saturday, September 2nd, 10:03 p.m. At the ticket counter, Jeff paid to be upgraded to business class, since first class was closed. The flight left Newark at 7:30 that evening. 2 hours out, they had dinner and shared a bottle of wine. Having talked it through before takeoff, they had nothing more to do until they reached Moscow. Daryl was in the window seat, covered with a blanket, her head wedged between the seat and the wall, sound asleep. Jeff looked at her tenderly, realizing that he was more concerned for her personal safety than his own, or the fate of the world for that matter. Was he right to bring her along? But was leaving her behind any safer? He just knew he couldn't bear the thought of losing her. Jeff booted his notebook and for a few minutes tried to lose himself in Mega Destructor 4. But it was useless. His current world was too real for him to find release in one of fantasy. He went online and checked the news. He could no longer consider any disaster without wondering if it was the super freak virus. A chip manufacturing plant in Taiwan had shut down overnight. No deaths, but management wasn't commenting on the cause. An entire office building in downtown Austin, Texas had lost all power. More than 30 people had been trapped in elevators and had to be manually extracted. The building was evacuated by using the emergency stairs. A commuter plane had crashed in Kansas with 17 dead. Which, if any of these, was Super Freak? How many others had occurred Jeff didn't know about? How many had died? Then a New York Times article caught his eye. Until now, he'd wondered why no one was putting this all together. He and Daryl had the advantage of being on the inside, but it had been more than 3 weeks since the attack started. The failure of the U.S. government security agencies to come on board was inexcusable. But how hard could it be for the media to start connecting the dots? Or at least to ask the right questions. And there it was. Using the local computer-related hospital deaths as a hook, the reporter wrote about a series of unusual incidents nationwide. These included some Jeff already knew about, but several he did not, including the apparent destruction of a Midwest bank's database, the unscheduled shutdown of 2 more nuclear power plants, and the loss of several significant internet routing systems. A source within the White House, the article said, confirms that the president has already directed that a national security assessment report be submitted to him as quickly as it can be prepared. The source would neither confirm nor deny that the many incidents are related, nor comment on another report that they are part of a coordinated effort directed against computers worldwide. That at least is something, Jeff thought as he closed the computer, put it away, then leaned back in his seat. They still haven't put it together, but are starting to. When someone finally did, Jeff couldn't help but wonder how much damage the reaction itself would cause. He listened to the engines for several minutes, then glanced over at Daryl again. This is crazy, he thought for the 100th time since hearing the shots. We're not secret agents. Earlier, once they'd been satisfied no one was chasing them, Jeff had grabbed a taxi and had them dropped off at Central Park. He'd found a large open field, and from there, convinced he could see anyone approaching, trusting the outdoors rather than a closed space, he and Daryl had discussed what to do. "Do you think we should go to the cops?" she asked, even though when she'd suggested this earlier in Jeff's hotel room, they dismissed the suggestion. But bullets fired from an assassin's gun now gave weight to what then had seemed a far-fetched scenario. "No, they wouldn't believe us. We might be detained as witnesses or even suspects, and there's no time to lose right now. If we don't put a stop to this, no one will. There's simply too much at stake to take such a chance." Daryl's face was tight with anxiety. They stood in silence for a long minute. "Do you think the cop is dead?" Daryl finally asked. "What happened to the other man, the one who was chasing us?" Jeff shook his head. "I don't know about the cop. He went down.
The other guy ran to the corner, but it didn't look like he chased us past that. Who do you think he is? The same guy who killed Sue and Joshua Green.
Daryl nodded.
Me too, but why us?
Sue and Green were tortured. Sue must have told him who was helping her.
Maybe we should get a gun. I mean, if it's up to us to defend ourselves.
In Manhattan? And trust me, I'd be more of a threat to us with a gun than anyone else. I've never so much as shot one.
He scanned the park and saw no one approaching them.
You should warn Harold. That's his name, right?
Good thinking.
Jeff called the IT center and reached Harold, who'd had no trouble accepting the need to disappear. He told Jeff he was already considering it and had just the place.
Daryl sat on the grass. 30 feet away, a young couple were helping their child learn to walk, clapping with pleasure every time he managed 3 or 4 steps.
Jeff started working his BlackBerry with his thumbs.
I've got us on a flight to Moscow leaving from Newark tonight.
You got your passport?
Daryl looked at him with excitement.
Never leave home without it. Are you thinking what I think you're thinking?
Our problem isn't that someone's trying to kill us. Our problem, Daryl, is that in 9 days Muslim terrorists are going to unleash an enormous, sophisticated attack on the Internet and the United States.
And we're the only ones in a position to do something about it. If you've got a better idea, I'd like to hear it.
Much had happened since Jeff had first set foot in that Manhattan law office. In some ways, it was a lifetime. He'd gone from a significant, if relatively mundane job, to realizing that his life was on the line, though he was still just a small part of the solution to a much bigger and more important problem. But there was more. He finally understood where he'd gone wrong in the weeks and days leading up to 9/11. He'd been too passive, too trusting. He'd looked to others for solutions. Now he understood he should have raised holy hell. When Carlton had ignored him, he should have gone up the chain and kept going up until someone listened. If that had not been possible, he should have gone public, no matter what the risk to his career. He'd known he was right, and he'd known what needed to be done. If nothing else, a public disclosure of what he'd found might very well have frightened the terrorists off, caused them to delay their attack. Who knew what would have happened then? That was the true source of his anger, he realized. Some part of him had always known he'd sold himself short, and in so doing, had doomed more than 3,000 people, including the woman he'd loved. That was all changed. No more would he sit back and play the guilt-ridden victim. And there was Daryl. She was risking everything without a second thought. His feelings had come on him slowly, but what he thought no longer possible was now a reality. He had to do this, for both their sakes, and for the sake of the 3,000 he'd already failed.
Let me make some calls.
Daryl pulled out her cell phone and began with her office. Satisfied that they were now safe, Jeff led her to a sidewalk vendor as she talked. Buying black coffee and donuts, he laughed at the absurdity of it all, and the sudden realization that getting shot at in real life was nothing like being one of the shooters in the video games he played. This was for keeps. By noon, Daryl tucked away her phone.
I've got my team on it. I told them I'm going to be traveling this week, trying to run down Super Freak. They think I'm joking. I've got some odd news, too.
Jeff raised his eyebrows.
I couldn't reach George Carlton. I wanted an update on where DHS is on this. They told me he left the country yesterday in a rush. Something about an appointment in Paris.
Jeff wrinkled his brow. What do you think?
She shrugged. I left a voicemail for his assistant, telling him I'd be out of touch for a few days, asking them to please take some action on Super Freak. Not that it will do any good. The guy had taken the weekend off, which tells me everything I need to know about how urgent they think this is.
Exasperated, Jeff said, what about the vendors?
No real change. We told them again it was avoiding their honeypots, and a few said they would look at generating some signatures for the samples we have. But that's way too little, way too late.
Jeff sighed. I checked the temperature in Moscow. It's colder than here. We should do a little shopping while we can, and get some cash. Credit cards don't work everywhere.
They'd made it to Newark with time to spare. At an airport hotspot, Jeff booked them into the Moscow Metropole Hotel for 3 nights.
Gotta love the Internet, he said as he put away his laptop.
Waiting to board, Daryl said, How are we going to find Super Freak?
You've got an address. We'll give it to a taxi driver.
Okay. Let's say it's that easy. We find him, then just ask him to turn over the viruses he's created? That doesn't sound like much of a plan.
We can always pay him.
Daryl brightened. Money's good. That might work. Then with a sinking heart, she added, if he's not a fanatic or something.
That's possible. But he's a Russian, and I'll bet he's a gun for hire.
Unless he's Chechenian.
Jeff frowned. Yes, there's always that.
Chapter 55. Moscow, Russian Federation. Moscow, Sheremetyevo International Airport. Sunday, September 3, 4:43 p.m. Brian Manfield marveled at how he could use his British passport to enter Russia. For a moment he recalled how he had infiltrated Russian lines in Grozny, first as a dirty-faced waif, worming his way close enough to use his knife, then later dressed as a Russian soldier on guard duty. Now he stepped off an airplane and handed the authorities a piece of paper, and they stamped it and all but gave him the keys to the city. Amazing. Somewhere he knew was a file under the name Boris Mansour, presumably with a grainy photograph of him as a gawky teenager. But no one in Russia had any reason to connect him with the distinguished British representative of SAS London. The trip had been exhausting. He'd taken Czech Airlines from Newark to Prague, then flown from the Czech Republic directly to Moscow. With luck, this Russian business would be quickly over, and he could go home. Outside, he took out his die, then put it away and got in the first taxi in line. He wanted to do nothing to attract the attention of authorities here in Moscow. Airport security watched for anything out of the ordinary. He stuck with English in speaking to the driver.
The Golden Ring Hotel, you know it?
Oh, yes, sir, very nice hotel. You will like. Very pretty women stay there in bar.
The driver had not shaved in 3 days. He was middle-aged, with a dark complexion.
I can give you name of special one. Very nice. College girl, looking to meet handsome English gentleman.
No, thank you.
They drove for a few minutes, then the driver said,
nice boys and young men, too.
No, thank you. I'll keep the offer in mind.
Here, the driver said, never taking his eyes off the road. Take my card. You call me for anything anytime, okay? I make your stay very good indeed, very special.
Manfield glanced at the card as he moved to put it into his pocket, intending to toss it as soon as he checked in. Stopping, he read the name on the card.
Vaka Dukovaka, a Chechen.
How are you, my brother? Manfield asked in Chechen. With astonishment, the man met Manfield's eyes for the first time in the rearview mirror.
I am good, Allah be praised, he answered in the same language.
Praise be to Allah, my brother. The car sped along the wide Moscow street toward the city center. Finally, Vaka said in Chechen,
you look the perfect English gentleman.
We are all two faces in this world, my brother.
Yes, Vaka agreed, his voice sounding sad. If I can help you, only say the word.
Manfield thought. He'd taken the first taxi. Then the driver turned out to be a Chechen brother. The odds of that were not so long. Many of the taxi drivers in Moscow were Chechen. Should he be suspicious? At times, Allah handed you a gift. A few minutes later, the taxi pulled up before the Golden Ring Hotel.
I must check in, Manfield said. Wait for me.
He handed the man some of the rubles he'd acquired at the airport.
I will wait. Keep your money, my brother, the driver said, waving the rubles off. I will be there.
He indicated a spot just down the street. As Manfield checked in, he said to the clerk in English, I'm expecting a package.
Yes, sir, just a moment. The young man returned with a wrapped box the size of a laptop. Here you are, sir. It arrived earlier today.
In his room, Manfield washed, then changed into casual clothes. He opened the package and removed the pistol. This time it was a Russian Makarov 380, the Soviet equivalent of the German PPK. Included was an extra magazine already full. He checked the automatic and found a bullet in the chamber and the magazine filled. In the package was a folding knife with a single 4-inch locking blade. This one was Swiss and a bit larger than he was accustomed to, but of high quality. A message on a slip of paper was written in Russian.
No photo available. The name is Vladimir Koskov, late 20s, in a wheelchair. Destroy all computers. Finally, there was the fully charged cell phone, which he turned on. He placed the items into his pockets, memorized the address, then tore it up and flushed the message. 30 minutes after arriving, Manfield left the hotel, spotted the taxi, and entered the back seat. He gave the driver an address. Drive carefully. I wish to attract no attention. I understand. Chapter 56. Moscow, Russian Federation. Dmitrovsky Administrative District. Sunday, September 3, 6:21 p.m. Ivana Koskov was satisfied with the bedroom. She'd been able to buy a new IKEA bedroom set and was thrilled. They finally had enough room for her things and a bed big enough for the two of them. Vladimir had suggested twin beds, but she was determined to continue sleeping with him. In the corner of the room was an unoccupied place where she mentally placed the baby crib. Their old living room furniture was to be delivered the next day, so that room was still empty. She'd carefully written their new address on tape that she'd placed on every piece of furniture and on the boxes containing their odds and ends so there'd be no mistakes. She trusted her father, but had no idea whom he'd bring to work with him the next day. Her father was staring out the window. "You can just see the river from here," he said. Ivana went into the small second bedroom. She had bought a proper workstation for Vladimir, and earlier, with a cousin and her father, had moved his main computer. Vladimir would be moving in this night, and tomorrow she and her father would finish moving in the rest of his computer equipment. Once he was set up here, there was no rush to move anything else from their old place. She had the week. Her best friend from work, visiting family in St. Petersburg, had lent her an aging Lada to help with the move. Ivana's plan was to be completely installed in the new apartment by the end of the next weekend. She was thrilled at the idea. Even Vladimir was coming around. Having his own room in which to work was too inviting. Ivana was certain that the change in environment, the more open space, and a baby on the way would bring back the young man she'd always loved with such devotion. "You've done well," her father said. Ivana smiled. "Thank you. I found it, but Vlad is paying." The man grunted. There'd been no vodka that day, and for that she was grateful. Tonight would be different, though. "Let's get your man, then. He'll finish up his things tomorrow while you are at work." "Thank you, Grandpa." "Dead? What are you talking about?" Ivana touched her stomach. "It was confirmed Friday. Don't tell Vlad he doesn't know yet." "Grandpa! I like the sound of that." His eyes grew warm. "Have you decided on the name if it's a boy?" Chapter 57. Moscow, Russian Federation. Metropole Hotel. Sunday, September 3, 6:33 p.m. Jeff had been surprised at how much the Metropole Hotel resembled the office building for Fisherman, Platt, and Cohen. As he examined the Art Deco motif, he decided they'd been built around the same time and had been influenced by the same architectural style. The coincidence was eerie, yet the building could not have been better located. It was across the street from the Bolshoi Theater and just a short walk from the Kremlin, not that they'd have time to take in the sights. In their room, they showered and changed, discussing plans as they could. "I'm for just going to the address tonight," Darrell said. "If it's a business or someone else is living in the apartment, we might as well find out. Then we can start fresh in the morning." "I agree." Winging it like this held a certain excitement, but he couldn't help second-guessing his decisions. Events were sweeping them along. It was reassuring to have Darrell's steady presence. He didn't think this was something he could do alone. "We don't have much time. Ready when you are." Jeff had dressed in gray running shoes, dark wool slacks, a long-sleeved wool shirt, and a lined black leather jacket he'd bought in Manhattan. A pair of gloves was tucked into the jacket's pockets, along with a black watch cap. Darrell came out of the bathroom and laughed. The only difference in their attire was that her leather jacket was a dark brown, and instead of a watch cap, she had a scarf folded into her jacket pocket. Downstairs, the couple asked for a taxi with a driver who spoke English. It was apparently not an unusual request, as the doorman merely gestured, and one of the waiting cars pulled from the line
and drove to the entrance. As they slid into the back seat, Daryl asked the driver, "Do you know this address?" She handed him a slip of paper. The man glanced at the paper, nodded, and drove off. "I can't believe we're here," Jeff said, watching the trees and buildings whip by outside the car. "It is surreal," Daryl agreed. "Let's think about what's going to happen if we meet Super Freak. Any thoughts on how to handle the approach?" Jeff shook his head. "We'll just have to play it by ear. Some things you just can't plan ahead for."